Welcome to the Lies Between Us show. This is Roger A. Byrd, and we will dig into the truths and challenges of trying to live life as we might wish. Both at home and at work, we struggle with the gap between where we are and where we would like to be. Trying to peel back the layers of those things that bind us, we will see if we can find an easier path forward. We are all in this together, so this show is about us. It's my honor to introduce, as my co-host for episode number 10, a dear old friend of mine. I've known him, I think, 93, we first met. John Stampstead is a father, a cyclist, and a highly successful ultramarathon athlete. In running, John has run multiple ultra events, including twice at the UTMB, which is the Ultra Trail Mont Blanc in France. He's run the John Muir Trail, which is 200 miles long through Yosemite, unsupported. And he also ran the White Rim Trail in Utah, which was 100 miles, again, unsupported. Cycling, John is the 8-time winner of the Alaska I Did a Sport race. He did the first timed ride of the Great Divide Trail, which is 2,500 miles from Banff, Canada to Mexico. He also rode 3,500 miles off-road across Australia. He's also in the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame. Like I said, I first met John in 1993 in Davis, West Virginia. He was on the opposing team during the 24 hours of Canaan mountain bike race. He was teammates with Gene Oberpiller, famous in the Minneapolis scene, and then Willie Gagan and Floyd Landis. And then he started racing solo. Last week, he was out on the Cross Washington Trail, attempting to ride his mountain bike 680 miles, pretty much nonstop. He's been in several films. I've worked with him in the bike industry. And I don't know if I know a more extreme athlete and human than John Stampstead. I have a ton of admiration for this guy. He has all of my respect and more. And John Stampstead, welcome. And why don't you give everybody an update on what's going on in your world?
Well, thanks, Roger. It's really an honor to be here. I like what you're doing with this podcast. It's a very cool project that you have. So I'm honored to be a part of that. Yeah, I'm just moving along, living life with my kids, trying to survive this COVID world and not get COVID, even though I feel pretty healthy at the moment. Some of the stories scare me, and I do have, you know, asthma, and I've been in the past prone to pneumonia. So that's not a good thing to have on your medical resume if you get COVID. So, you know, hoping that we can get through this challenging apocalyptic time. But it's also, I like things that change our view of day-to-day life, and there aren't very many. It's also, you know, can be looked at as a centering event for, I think, a lot of people. I'm trying to get my kids to appreciate the gravity of it. Like, this is going to shape their next, you know, however many decades, and how the world, you know, responds to this and, you know, how we move forward. So I think it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I agree with you. My kids are 17 and 20. I know your two oldest are a little south of that or close to that, right?
I've got 23, 17, and 14.
Oh, yeah. You're right there. I think generally, I wouldn't call it a silver lining, but I would say that it's an opportunity for us to reimagine a life that we would have never been challenged to consider before. So there is an opportunity, and it's horrible that people have gotten sick and died and lost their jobs and lost their businesses. And it's a hard reset, whether you like it or not. And there's been plenty of other people who have prospered wildly.
Yeah, it's been very unfair in terms of who it affects and who it doesn't. And I think we'll feel the effects of that for a long time to come, you know, as well. Really penalizes the poor. And for some reason, you know, the stock market keeps going up, which, you know, seems like that can't not be a bubble that has to burst.
You would think.
Yeah.
All right. Well, is that it for now? And we'll get into the rest of it, or anything else happening in your world?
No, otherwise just boring day to day.
Cool. Well, I don't think I need to worry about this. I certainly don't have to worry about this with you, but I only have one rule in the podcast, and that is total truth or pass. Instead of going down a rabbit hole that you'd rather not journey through, just say pass, and we can edit it out. But if you don't think it's going to be valuable to people, skip over it. Say, let's do another one.
I'm good with that.
Cool. Well, now you get to flip a coin and see who asked the first question. What kind of coin do you have over there in Seattle, Washington?
I have an Ulu, which is a Athapascan cutting knife. It was so two of the coolest awards that I ever got in my racing career were, one, the Frisbees from, you know, Laird's 24-hour events. And then up at the Alaska, I did a sport. We got Ulus. I use it for chopping vegetables. It's perfect.
Yeah. So it's like a palm held knife that has a circular cutting surface. And what would they typically use that for? Skinning or cutting meat?
Yeah, I think this was for skinning.
Skinning. Wow. You're going to flip that? All right. Well, keep your fingers out of the way.
And that's you. You get the first question.
Okay. Well, I'm going to just fire straight down the middle. It seems you have used your ultra events to keep yourself balanced. But a couple of years ago, you went in the opposite direction. Do you want to speak about the dark time of somewhere around 2 years ago?
Yeah. I knew when I was in my 20s that I had at least an addictive personality. And I knew that through bike racing, that was a really effective channel for me. I never really did drugs, you know, in college. You know, I drank to excess at times, but, you know, the same as everybody else did. And my sport really kept me sane. When you're fit, you do everything you can not to lose that. Like, there's a lot of inertia in both directions. Later on, like, I guess I started drinking after my career, and then when my second marriage was starting to fall apart, I drank to cope with that. And nothing, you know, ever spirals that quickly. Like, it takes a while. And then, like, 3 years ago, I had been drinking way too much, but started riding my bike again. And I was really, like, I thought I was close to kind of pulling it all together. And I got hit by a car. And not just hit, but, like, it shattered my leg. My left tib fib. So both bones and both of them broken in two places. So it was pretty messed up. And, you know, they bolted back together. So it wasn't an issue there. But, you know, the recovery from that is, it's kind of like you're old enough, the Joe Theismann, you know, football injury, or more recently, Alex Smith. You know, it's open fracture of the, you know, lower leg, has a history of, like, not coming back necessarily. And mine did not come back right away. I tried riding, you know, a few months, I tried riding, you know, as soon as I could bear it. And it was just too miserable. And, you know, like, every few months I would try it and still couldn't do it. And, you know, mentally I gave up, I guess. And, you know, my way of coping, you know, with depression was drinking, and really went downhill. To the point, like, I was literally drinking myself to death. And the only thing that, you know, saved me, which got me to quit drinking, I was having severe stomach problems. I would have these episodes where, you know, from chronic drinking, not, you know, chronic drinking like I drank too much that day, but chronic drinking like I was drinking too much in that last 2 months. And my stomach would shut down. And it would put me in the fetal position on the couch, and I couldn't do anything for a few days, which is, you know, a problem in a few ways. One, when you're an alcoholic and you take away the alcohol, you start going through severe withdrawal. So you start really getting messed up. It doesn't sound, you know, that flashy, you know, stomach problem. It was the worst pain I've ever felt in any way. Like, for whatever reason, for me, like, I broke my collarbone once. Like, you know, I didn't even take a pain pill for it. It didn't bother me. But this stomach problem was the worst thing that I had ever experienced. So that happened, you know, a number of times. And each time I swore, it's like, boy, you know, I don't want to go through that again. I should, you know, either stop drinking or get a handle on it, you know, at least. I held on to that, you know, dream of I can drink in moderation. I just need to, you know, I just need to get in shape and just need to get a, you know, a handle on it. Well, finally, one time it was so bad, my girlfriend took me to the hospital and they, you know, put me on detox because I was what was my blood pressure? It was like 160 over 140. Like, it was bad, like really bad. And they, you know, they would not let me leave the hospital for, you know, 18 days. And only then, because I had, you know, a gal I was seeing at the time, it's like, you have to watch him, you know, because, like, if you need to drink, drink, because you could die if you, you know, don't take the detox and, you know, come down slowly. And that, you know, event, not that it was, like, it had happened a bunch of times, but that was the last straw for me. I was like, I quit. And for me, there was definitely a time where I never thought I'd be able to quit drinking. Like, I'd almost given up even trying. But at the same time, you know, I do have a lot of resolve. And when I said, you know, I quit, I meant it. And that was a year and a half ago, and haven't had a drink, you know, since. Have no desire to. I have no compulsion to. Like, I know a lot of people who have had drinking problems and, you know, they can't be around it, or, you know, it's a daily struggle. And I feel for those folks. At least, you know, now I do not have that. You know, when I think of drinking, I don't think of having a good time or, you know, a fun partying. I think of the misery. And, you know, while I've got enough self-control, you know, now, like, I could have a drink and it wouldn't necessarily spiral into being blackout. But I do know if I started drinking again, I'd end up in the same place.
You would just open that door again.
Yeah, I'd be there. You know, maybe it takes a month, maybe it takes 2 months, but I'd be there and I'd be miserable. And I was miserable for years. And so, you know, I'm happy now, but it was hard to get there. It took a long time.
You know, I know we've talked about this a little bit. I know that you gained some weight. You were unhealthy in so many ways. And how long did that extreme unhealthiness go on, kind of start to finish for you? Not just the drinking.
About 10 years ago, when my marriage started falling apart. I remember my then wife came home one day and was complaining to me about how she had to have a job. And she looked me in the eye and she said, "I refuse to be married to a sales rep," which I almost laugh about now, but I was a sales rep. And that's kind of what I was going to be. And I remember I even, you know, thought, well, you know, people say things in anger. They walk them back. You know, I kind of broached it again with her later, and she never walked that back, you know, not even an inch. And so that's when nothing necessarily changed like that day, but that's when I knew it's like, oh, all right. Like, this has an end date. Like, you know, this isn't going to work out. And that was, you know, when I started, you know, filling those holes, you know, with alcohol. And again, like, it didn't, you know, it didn't start one day and then I was a belligerent, you know, drunk. It's just, you go from being an athlete and never wanting to wake up, you know, hungover, you know, to going out and, because at that time I was doing ultra runs and, you know, I was doing well. It was recreation for me. It wasn't, you know, I was just doing it for fun, but it was pure joy to be able to do that. But then you get into the pattern where you're having a beer every day at 5 o'clock, you know, instead of like Friday night or, you know, social times, it's every day at five. And then if 5 o'clock works, well, 4 o'clock, how much difference is that? It's only an hour. Who cares? And then it's 3 o'clock. And then it's like, well, maybe I'll have a beer, you know, with my lunch. Then you've got this lag period, you know, before your 5 o'clock or whatever, and you start to feel bad. So you're like, well, I better keep that buzz going. And then you're just down, like you don't come back. You know, it's kind of an interesting, the de-evolution of a, you know, of a real alcoholic. I remember there was a period where I'd wake up at night, like every night, you know, because you start not sleeping well. And I'd wake up at night and couldn't get back to sleep. And it was because, you know, my blood alcohol got, you know, below a certain point. And then, it, you know, you wake up. Well, then I discovered that if you just have a drink, then you can get right back to sleep. And you rationalize it by saying, well, it's probably not a good thing, you know, to wake up in the middle of the night and drink, but I'm getting more sleep. You know, I'm sleeping an extra 2 hours, so maybe it benefits me.
Medicine.
That's when you're gone. That's when you can't stop drinking. Because you physically can't stop. Like there was definitely points where I could have stopped and it was no, or, you know, you have times where you do, like maybe you take a week off or something. But once I crossed that threshold, you're a lifer. Like you can't take a day off. You can't take 10 hours off. And then you start having, you know, health problems. Like I gained just from racing. I went from 135 pounds to 180-ish. I would always stop weighing myself if I ever hit 179. I never wanted to see 180. And then I wouldn't weigh myself again until I'd been sick or something and I knew I'd dropped a few pounds. But I'm sure, like, I was probably 183, you know, or something at my max. And I was 180-ish pounds just a year ago, June. I started riding my bike and I'm at, you know, back to my 135, same weight I was my entire adult life, that 10-year lost decade.
Yeah. What do you think you lost of most value during your drinking?
And, you know, again, part of the reason that I really drank, the sense of loss at losing that nuclear family. And like, you can still have a relationship, you know, with your kids when you're divorced, as you know. For me, especially, you know, I had younger kids with my second divorce. So there was a lot more guilt, you know, involved with that on my end. And losing that was really painful for me, brutally.
Yeah. When my first marriage fell apart, the woman I have two children with, I'd been a drug addict, hardcore drug addict for a long time, but I had like 15 years clean. And then the marriage fell apart and I never saw it coming. And I started drinking immediately and I was an alcoholic for 5 years. And I didn't feel like I could control it. As disciplined as I was with my athletics, and I knew I wasn't going back to drugs because, you know, I take one hit off a joint and next thing you know, I'm shoving meth in my arm. So I know that I couldn't do that, but it's a fast switch, man. That's a tough one.
Yeah, some of the traits that, you know, make people really good athletes also make them really good drug addicts and alcoholics. The traits are very similar.
Yeah. I have a lot of friends of mine that are amazing athletes and they definitely have a lot of shit in their head that they're running from, or they're trying to battle. They're trying to win the race against their monsters in their head. It's a crazy thing, but thank goodness a lot of us have found athletics and have stayed alive thus far.
How did you stop drinking after your divorce, that 5 years?
I was dating heavily. Match.com was my friend after my first divorce. And then I just met a woman who I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. And I married her. She was my second wife. And she had a tough childhood and similar to mine. And we drank heavily. We partied. We'd go to Vegas just to party. And her and I both, very close in time to each other, drank ourselves under the table and almost 6 foot under. So it was just an eye opener. And I was like, I was never a drinker and I'm just getting rid of it. And, you know, her kid lived with us and I had two kids and we had three little kids and there was no way. I chose my kid's life over my own. And we just decided. Her and I looked at each other and said, you have to stop. And it's like, you have to stop too. Here's what this looks like. We wrote it down and signed a contract and that was it. 2011, 9 years ago. But what motivated you the most? I mean, you talk about your stomach problems and, you know, trying to be mindful of your three children and trying to be mindful of your career and maybe even some sponsors that you have, because you've always been sponsored because you're a stud. But what really motivated you to just decide to stop drinking?
It's never one thing. Things come together, you know, for everyone, it's you know, different. And that's why drug treatment is such a nightmare. There isn't one cause, you know, one cure to that disorder.
But wasn't there a straw that broke the camel's back? Or wasn't there one thing that just finally sunk in or hit you that you were just like, okay, screw it, that's it?
Yeah, well, it was the just severe, you know, pain I was in from the health issue. Like if there's, you know, one event for the timing, you know, that was it. But I knew I'd been going through that stomach problem for probably a year. And so I had experienced that. But I think it was like I had people, like you get a lot of advice, you know, when you have a problem of how you should fix yourself. And, you know, you kind of find out who your friends are and you lose a lot of friends because they won't do things the way that, you know, they think you should. So, you know, it looks like you are being derelict. You know, I had a lot of people tell me to do AA, and I tried AA, and AA works for a lot of people. I have friends who, for them, it has completely saved them and it's changed their life. For me, it doesn't work. It just doesn't resonate. But you have people who tell you, it's like, well, AA doesn't work for you because, you know, you didn't try hard enough. And if you would just try harder, you know, it works every time. And if it doesn't work, it's because you didn't try hard enough. And I don't like that mentality. You know, that really rubs me the wrong way. And I think for that, like 6 months, you know, leading up to when I actually quit, I had a old high school friend who, you know, I would see on Facebook, and he does drug treatments. And he would, like every Friday or Monday or whatever, list his thoughts of the day, which are usually totally corny. And, you know, on Facebook, they kind of drive me nuts. You know, they're so silly. But his were really, really good. And it was about, you don't have to shame an addict. You know, he believed in there's a lot of different paths, you know, correcting the situation and even correcting it. There's, you know, a lot of different ways, definitions of what that could be. You know, and mitigation, you know, might be work for some and, you know, not for others. And then I also had a girlfriend at the time. And usually when you're in, you know, a relationship and you have a drug or alcohol problem, you know, it's common to get if you really cared about me, you would, you know, take care of this problem. Or if you cared about your kids, you know, more like just building up the shame. which is the worst thing you can possibly do. For me, it made everything worse. It just made me feel, you know, more self-loathing. And then that's more reason, you know, to drink. But I had this girlfriend who was really nice and just said, you know, I care about you either way. You know, you should probably, you know, quit drinking because, you know, if you look at your life, you might want to consider that. But she said, you know, I'll be your friend or girlfriend regardless. And just that, it gave a calm environment for me to approach it. Like there wasn't as much pressure. Like if I had tried to quit and failed, I still would have had a support system. And I think that was really important, at least for me. I needed a good support system, which apparently I hadn't had in the past. But so I felt, you know, I felt safe trying. And then it really came down to, you know, I wanted to live. I would never have killed myself, I don't think, but I would have gone down the road of neglect. Like that's where I was headed.
They could have killed you. Plenty of people die from alcoholism and they didn't intend to kill themselves.
Exactly. Like I've had two, you know, friend acquaintances have that happen to them in the last 2 years.
I'm sorry.
They drank themselves to death.
I'm sorry. That's a brutal way to go.
And I got a heart rate monitor, or I started using one that I had. My resting heart rate was never going below 80.
Oh my God.
And, you know, when I was an athlete, my resting heart rate was usually around 40, you know, 39 to low or mid 40s, kind of depending.
Yeah.
I remember thinking like when I was going to the doctor with my broken leg, I remember thinking, I was like, what are they going to think when they take my pulse and it's 90, you know, in the doctor's office? Like, you can't not know that something is awry here. I'm like, they didn't seem to really, it's like 90. Well, that's a tiny bit high. I'm like, yeah. Cause I was even, you know, I was drinking then.
I used to go to the dentist and I've had some bad face mouth injuries from bike racing. And I'd go to the dentist and they'd be like rebuilding part of my mouth. And they're like, can you feel that? I was like, oh yeah. And they're like, can you feel that? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, we've never had to put so much medicine in someone before. And I said, well, I was just shooting up 30 minutes ago in the car. So it's no wonder.
Yeah. So that, you know, that having the high heart rate a couple of years, like 2 years, I think it was crazy high. I just thought I was doing permanent damage to myself.
So that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, was your health, pretty much. I mean, I'm sure there's a million things on top of that.
Yeah, it was, you know, everything coming together at the right time. And, you know, finally I decided to try and start living again. Another good suggestion that my friend Mimi suggested was, she said, you should try a dry run at quitting. You know, just give it a try, but assume you're going to start drinking again, which seems super counterproductive or counterlogical to, you know, how you quit. You're supposed to swear on the Bible that tomorrow you're never going to have a drink again as long as you live, or your kids will hate you, or, you know, some guilt, shame.
Right.
Oh, so I did the dry run, and at that time, I did a super, you know, super slow taper. Like I just weaned off and then I was able to stop. And I stopped for, you know, like 2 weeks. But then, like, I wasn't doing anything active. So I just started drinking again because I was kind of, you know, bored, you know, just purely out of boredom, you know, and did the same thing. Like you started at five. It's like, well, I made it through the day. That's awesome. I'll just have a couple of drinks. And then I think it was only 2 months later that, you know, my stomach blew up again. And that was when I quit for good. But I think it really did help, even though, like, it was brutally hard when I actually quit because I didn't have the luxury of tapering. So I went from full booze to zero with, you know, some, you know, medical intervention detox. Can't remember what the medicine was, but I was on that for a day or two.
Yeah.
And that helped. I knew that sitting around my apartment was unsustainable. I knew I would never, you know, be able to stay off. So I got a job as a bike messenger. And I think that's the only way that I was able to pull it off and stop drinking was because I was on my bike all day. And for me, exercise really equates to brain chemistry improvement, you know, and I think if you look at the reasons, you know, why I drank, you know, why I rode my bike, and I'm interested to ask you about this, the nature versus nurture as to why you go down that path. For me, I really think it's physical brain chemistry, you know, issues. And for whatever reason, you know, the dopamine or the serotonin, when I exercise, whether it's running or riding my bike, I am a better, happier, everything in my universe is better. And without that, like I remember when I first stopped racing back in 2000, I thought I was looking forward, you know, to quitting because, like, you know, it's exhausting training. Like, I thought, man, I'm going to have tons of energy. I'm going to feel so good. I can't, you know, I can't wait to attack the day. I felt terrible. Like, I had no energy. I wasn't, you know, I didn't drink then, but I felt horrible, had no energy. And so that's when I started trail running. I was like, well, I need to do something. You know, after doing cycling, you know, I was kind of burned out on that. So I wanted to do something new. And, you know, running was good because everything I did was motivating. Like every run was a PR because I, you know, hadn't, you know, done it much. So it was very mentally stimulating to me. And, you know, that kept my brain chemistry going for another, whatever, 5 or 8 years, 8 years, I guess.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned kind of the deeper meaning to that addiction. And I think you even talked about that a little bit with Steve during the My Back 40 podcast. And, you know, I've had a couple other guests on my show, co-hosts on my show. Dennis Dodson was one. And then Ray Petro, you know, owner of Ray's Mountain Bike Parks. Ray talks about, especially alcoholism, that sometimes you're just not done yet. You know, you're not ready to be done drinking. But Dennis really got deep into the addiction, whatever it is, there's something behind it. And I think you had mentioned at one point, your dad liked to throw one back every once in a while. Where do you, besides your brain chemistry, where do you think you got the taste for alcohol?
I don't blame my upbringing or my, you know, parents for anything. And I went through that phase, like in the 90s, it was kind of popular to blame your parents for everything. And I think I went through that phase, but I got out of it. I don't, you know, my dad was a kind of a stereotypical engineer. Like he was, didn't talk a lot, wasn't touchy-feely, huggy, you know, that kind of guy. But he did, you know, he did his best. Like I don't harbor any negative feelings for my upbringing. I mean, I grew up really painfully shy. Like I just couldn't talk and was not social at all and kind of had to relearn those skills. You know, in my 20s, I went to, you know, therapy in my 20s to deal with that. Cause I knew, like, I just, once I got into college and then get out in the world, I knew I wasn't like, you know, everyone else. I couldn't socialize, you know, in the way that other folks could. So I tried to learn those skills, but yeah, I do. I think it's, you know, in my DNA, not necessarily the way that I was raised, but, you know, more my chemistry that totally predisposed to depression. My brother struggled with it his entire life and eventually killed himself.
Sorry. When did that happen?
Try and blot it out. He killed himself maybe 10 years ago, 10 or 12 years ago.
Sorry. I lost a niece 3 years ago to that same thing.
Yeah, it's a brutal torture that it's not very well understood, and there's not as much compassion for it. Kind of, you know, it's similar to, you know, depression and drug abuse are similar in that you get a lot of people saying, well, just pull it together. Just fix yourself. If you're depressed, well, you should do things that make you feel better. Do some positive things. It's like, well, no, when you're in a good place, you do things that are good for you. And when you're in a bad place, you're not in the frame of mind to do that. You do the opposite usually.
You're stuck.
Yeah. So that's a challenge. But I was lucky, you know, to be successful in racing because that helped with my self-esteem. You know, that helped, you know, alleviate any depression that, you know, might have been there. The success kind of covered up, you know, any of that. Not that I didn't try and actively work on it, but like it just kept it, you know, on the down low.
Yeah. At least you had that to fall back on.
Whereas like my brother did not.
Sorry. Okay. Well, I'm sure some of that might pop back up, but now it's your turn to ask me a question.
Well, changing gears slightly, and we'll get back into that, but reminiscing, the other place where you and I may have connected was in the late 80s in Vail. I was wondering what the story was with you and that. Like, why did you move out there? And then I went to Copper Mountain in 86. I was there like in Frisco, which just over the pass from Vail from 86 to 88 or 89 after school. Did the ski bum thing, rode my bike in the summer.
I was in Vail and Avon, where Beaver Creek is. I was there two summers, two winters. So I was there the summer of 86 when Tomax stormed on the scene. And I wasn't around to see it because I was just doing all these Colorado races. But I decided to become a ski bum instead of dying as a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just stopped shooting up. So I was a junkie. And I had four friends who stepped forward and helped me get off the needle. And it took a long time. And then when I was pretty soundly off the needle, I moved to Vail. My sister was supposed to go with me. She ended up not going at the last minute, but I went anyway. I packed everything I owned into my car, my little shitty Subaru station wagon. I was in Baltimore. I lived in Baltimore, and I just started driving west. And I didn't know if I was going to end up in Crested Butte or Aspen or Jackson Hole. I had no idea. No idea. I had $400 cash in my pocket, no credit card, no debit card. And I was just off and running. And I landed in Vail and got a job immediately with the bike shop. And I carried a lot of anger in my youth. It wasn't as much outward anger. It was just, I'd lose my cool quickly. I'd be building a model car and I'd smash it to bits, you know? I had no patience. And the drug addiction was really hard on me. And I was still doing drugs. I was still doing all the stuff. I just wasn't using the needle.
How did those drugs, I've never done those, how do they affect you? Like, you know, in terms of being an athlete, did you notice any severe effects or?
I was barely an athlete when I was a drug addict. I started riding mountain bikes when I had already been a drug addict for 6 years.
What year did you start riding?
83. And, you know, I went to the Ross race in Massachusetts, which was like a Norba National. All the Fisher guys were there. Joe Murray was there. Ned Overend was there. Cindy Whitehead was there in Massachusetts, you know. But I needed to try to stay alive. And I knew that I had to get the hell out of Baltimore. Baltimore is a very successful drug addict community. I think it's the heroin overdose capital of the world per capita. But I had to get out of there. And I love the mountains. You know, when I was in the mountains, they just grabbed me and talked to me. And they held me tight and kept me safe and made me feel loved. And I just had to be in the mountains. And I knew it. And no matter where I went, You know, I'd go to Vermont skiing or I'd go to the Appalachians, and it just, it wasn't enough. So I had to move out west. So I started racing a little bit more in 86. I teamed up with two guys. There were only three guys in Vail that rode mountain bikes in 86. And I teamed up with both of them and we'd carpooled all the mountain bike races together. And they both went on to be big successful pros. And that's what I thought I wanted to do, but I was still using. And I wasn't ready to just stay in Vail. There were some things tugging at me. And got into a big fight with my boss and I drove back to Baltimore in like one day. And I carried with me some fitness and some altitude fitness. And I was doing cyclocross races and winning the A race on my mountain bike. And I was like, you know what? This might work. And I ended up 2 years later, after I moved back to Baltimore, I quit drugs entirely. And then I got my Norba professional license the next year and I was off and running. So
Colorado was fun. That was a fun time to be out there. I really enjoyed that.
Really fun. You could barely do wrong out there between Summit County and Vail Beaver Creek.
You ever ride with Tom Knox? He's a racer. Every Wednesday, we would do the quad loop, Quadralupe, they'd call it. It was Frisco, up Fremont to Leadville, over around Vail, and then back up and over Vail Pass.
No, there was a hill climb series in Vail, and there was a time trial series in Vail. And then the Colorado off-road series was just a vibrant scene. And that year, Norba kind of fell apart. So a lot of California pros came to Colorado because there was good money. And so there was this vibrant race scene. And I was racing. I was training for racing while I was still, you know, smoking crack and smoking pot and doing pills and all the other stuff. But bike racing began to take over. And the two guys I hung out with, the only two other guys in Vail that rode mountain bikes, they were serious. One of them was like a pro mogul skier. And he ended up being like one of the most successful adventure racing athletes in the world. Mike Closure.
Yeah,
Closure. And the other one was Dave Turner. Dave Turner turned pro and now he owns his own bike company. I mean, Turner Bikes is one of the most successful full suspension companies out there. So I hung out with those two guys and they weren't smoking pot. They weren't doing anything. Dave Turner's mom used to come to the races every once in a while. You know, she'd come visit and she'd be handing us water bottles. But I hid my addiction from almost everybody.
Which drugs were you doing at that time?
A lot of cocaine, a lot of the barbiturates. So Tunols, Secanols, Placidils, Quaaludes. They don't really make the barbiturates anymore, but benzos, I think they call them now. And smoking a lot of pot. I'd smoke a quarter ounce of weed a day by myself. But, you know, on some level, some of that motivated me to go ride my bike. I did my own first bike packing trip, you know, up around Vail. I just carried a bunch of shit on my bike and just went up in the hills overnight. It was fantastic. Cool time to be alive for sure.
Yeah, I didn't mountain bike at all then. I was road riding. I was doing long distance road stuff.
Yeah. You did that crazy ass like 600 mile ride from like St. Louis.
Yeah, St. Louis to Kansas City and back. 550 miles across Missouri. That was pretty cool.
And that was like 85. Is that right before you moved to Summit County?
I think I came back and did that. I did that Missouri race twice. The first time I did it, I had just started riding a bike like that summer. And that was when I was young and, you know, thought, well, 3 months of riding, probably never be in better shape than that, you know? And so I did it and I finished third and thought, wow, I'm not terrible at this.
I don't suck at this.
Yeah, maybe I should keep doing it. And then, you know, I did Shawamagon.
Yeah, here in Wisconsin, because you grew up in Madison. You grew up where I live now. You went to Madison West High School and you went to University of Wisconsin-Madison, where my son is right now.
Yeah, crazy intertwined stuff.
I know. There. And then you were in Cincinnati, right? And you were hanging out with Willie Gagan?
Yep.
Yeah.
Small world.
It is a small world. So, all right. Does that satisfy your question?
Yeah.
All right. My turn. What's been your biggest life-changing moment?
I would answer, well, I'll start with a couple of the obvious ones. You know, having a kid, I think that changed me and for the better more than anything. And, you know, I was, you know, somewhat unusual, you know, kind of peer group, like people who, you know, they're going to do the, you know, niche sport kind of for their adult life. There aren't many who get married and have kids. Like that's a small, super small club. But I knew when I was young that that was really important to me. Even though I'm divorced twice, you know, it was super important to me to have that. And I think while, you know, having a kid when you're trying to be a full-time athlete is also, it's challenging on one level, it made me better in every way. And I think at each step as my kids have come along, it's been different, you know, each time, and each kid is, you know, very unique and different, but they've, you know, the cliche, like I learn, you know, more from them than, you know, they learn, you know, from me. And I think it's a good give and take. So I'd say that having kids as a category more than anything, and then the obvious, you know, quitting drinking, because that gives me a second lease on life. Like I have, you know, a chance to restart and be productive again.
Are any of your kids kind of chasing you athletically? Are they in NYCA or are they playing other sports or what? And then also, second part of that question is, first, are they doing sports? Second is, did you have to push them to be athletic? Because that's something I've kind of struggled with on and off. I'm kind of past that now, but it was hard for me to figure that out.
I've never pushed them. I'm kind of anti, well, on one hand, I'm anti sports, but like I get in the moment too. And like, I can be that little league dad. I have to really restrain myself. And I'll sit with the opposing team's parents just so I don't get caught up into the, you know, go Jimmy, go kill him, you know? But so I've really refrained. And my two oldest haven't shown any interest. My youngest has been pretty obsessed with the usual sports, football, baseball, basketball, all of those. Like he's really passionate about them. And I think in a healthy way, like whatever season it is, that's the sport he's into. As soon as the season's over, it's like that sport is done, move on to the next one. But then it's kind of cool. He got into mountain biking this summer, not because of, you know, his dad, me, but his friends, because of the, you know, coronavirus and people having a lot more time on their hands. He started riding his bike. So that's kind of a brand new thing. But just a month ago, I taught him how to do a wheelie and awesome. He just sat there and wouldn't stop doing it until he got it. And I just thought it was fun for me.
That's super awesome. Wow.
But yeah, he wants to, you know, jump off things and, you know, do tricks. And I'm like, yeah, I'll find somebody to help you with that. Cause that's, I'm not that guy. But
yeah. Buy him a full face helmet.
For sure. But, you know, hopefully that's something that, you know, if he wants to stick with it, you know, I will, you know, encourage it as much as I can, but I refrain from being the overbearing soccer dad kind of thing.
Yeah, me too. I mean, my kids have shown great promise in a couple of sports and I let them do it, you know, and if they want to be on a traveling team, that's fine. As long as it didn't upset the apple cart too much as far as the rest of the family, but I tried to give them every opportunity, but I could have pushed, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's out better, I think, if you just provide access to whatever their interests are and, you know, hopefully they find a passion if they have a passion. Like if there's one thing I really hope for my kids, it's I hope they have a passion. I'm not invested into what that passion is, but, you know, I hope they are passionate about something and, you know, they can go for it in life because not everybody is, you know, that fortunate.
Yeah, they find it and they pursue it when they can actually exercise that muscle of engagement with the activity.
Well, and, you know, as you know, with different sports and as you know, from a hard sport like cycling, being good barely gets you in the door of being a real, you know, elite athlete. Like you have to be driven. Like you have to be obsessed. You know, you have to be, you know, OCD in a productive way or maybe in a, you know, almost unhealthy way. Otherwise, the training's too hard, competition's too hard. You'll never get there on talent alone.
Yeah, it's the ultimate commitment and it's discipline. you have to be disciplined. Despite what you're feeling, despite what you're seeing and smelling, you do it anyway, because that's your thing. So,
like, I remember the person who I've never seen more enthusiasm and just raw dedication and have someone apply it, Floyd Landis with biking.
Yeah.
At the 24 Hours of Snow, one of those years, we had to hide his bike on him because he wouldn't stop doing wheelies in the parking lot. And we're like, Floyd, you have a race tomorrow. Like, you need to rest. Rest your legs. That was thrilling to see. But to succeed on that level, you have to be that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. Of the people that I know, like I know personally, there's nobody more talented than Floyd. Raw talent. Mm-hmm. You know, in 95, after we won Canaan, we got in a motorhome. You know, we met at David Duval's house and we rented this big ass motorhome and we drove to Moab and Floyd was in the motorhome with us. And it was Brad Erickson too from Jameis. And we went out to do 24 Hours of Moab, and being with Floyd in that motorhome and playing Trivial Pursuit and all this other stuff, just understanding his approach on life. Do you know, have you ever heard him sing?
No.
He's an amazing singer. Hotel California came on, that whole album with the Eagles, during our motorhome trip in 95, and he blew us out of the water. Shocking. Guy's got an amazing voice. I reconnected with him a few years ago when we were in Leadville, but you're right, man. You gotta have it. And a lot of times, it's not necessarily your results on the bike that make you successful in the sport, because you can be
not at all.
You can be a jerk and nobody sponsors you and you don't get anywhere. And even, you know, a top 20 national pro, if you can do the outward facing stuff right and provide value to your sponsors, you don't have to be on top of the podium all the time and for people to still love you and support you, because, you know, you just need to be unique and special and bring value.
Yeah. And with, you know, my, you know, niche of a niche in a niche sport, you know, I'd kind of start from scratch with, you know, trying to portray my value, because there wasn't I'm a top 20 Norba guy or XX results. It's, you know, I'd be going to people and saying, hey, I did this or won this of an event they'd never even heard of. And reaction sometimes I would get, you know, I'd tell potential sponsors what I did and they're like, why would you do that?
I did a what?
Yeah. Like, why would anyone do that? So it was kind of an uphill, you know, stream. So it's cool, you know, now to see the way that long distance gravel and bike packing have gone. It's super mainstream and it's really fun. It's fun to see the sport, you know, grow from where it was back in those early days of the 80s, with both primitively in terms of equipment and then just what people think is possible in terms of endurances.
Yeah. I was hiking rim to rim to rim in the Grand Canyon a little ways back, and this guy comes by me going the other way, and he's got a mountain bike taken apart on his back. Both wheels are off, they're bungeed, and he's through hiking. So he's speed hiking. He's not carrying a bunch of stuff like I am. I'm like out there for 9 days walking 3 miles an hour. Who cares, right? He's like hauling ass. I was like, dude, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm doing this bike trail thing. See ya. I'm like, this is not a bike trail. And it's just the bike packing thing. Boy, that's really blowing up. That's an amazing experience. I get a lot of that. I do some longer stuff, just 24 hour stuff, but super cool. Man, you're amazing, dude.
The technology has changed it so much. It's made it approachable for so many more people. I think folks feel a lot more comfortable going into the middle of nowhere when they're carrying their Garmin inReach and they can, you know, always hit the panic button instead of really being out there with, you know, kind of zero safety net now. Like, you can get extracted from any situation. And then, like, the gear, it's half the weight and it's all better. So, you know, you're not carrying 50 pounds of gear trying to mountain bike, which is no fun. So now you got a light load, you can still mountain bike. For people doing an overnight, you know, it's not a reach endurance-wise. Like, anybody can do that. And so it's pretty fun for the average Joe or Jane.
Yeah, my friend Dennis, who he was my co-host on episode 3, 8, and 9, he just got back from a 2,500-mile bike packing from Santa Fe to DC. And that's super cool. And another friend of mine, Brett, here in Madison, is super stud, single speed, triple crown bike packing guy. So, man, I know that positive energy, and you started it all. You were like the first one to put the clock to the Great Divide Trail, which basically follows the Continental Divide. Just, that's ridiculous. 2,500 miles. What was that, like 18 days for you or something?
Yeah, with paper maps. Like when I look back on it, the navigation was by far the hardest, most frustrating thing. And now, like, I did this ride last week. It's laughable how easy it is to navigate now.
Yeah, it just talks to you.
You're just following a dotted line on your GPS. And you can be in a maze of trails, and you just follow the dotted line, and you're there. You can be exhausted. It can be dark. It doesn't matter. Whereas back in the day, you know, you come to an intersection, and you've got, you know, like 3 dirt roads within a quarter mile. None of them are marked. Like, there's no names on anything. And you're staring at a map, and you're trying to figure out which one.
You have no idea.
Yeah, which one goes where, and like, all right, where's north? Like, where am I, you know, got pull out a compass, and then you guess, and you know, a certain percentage of that time you guess wrong. So then you backtrack.
What a wonderful adventure.
You do like, part of the adventure is not knowing the outcome. Like, that's a good definition for me. Like, if you know the outcome, then it's not all that adventurous. You need to have some experiences that were unplanned. Sometimes those are challenging, and other times they're really rewarding and super cool. You never would have had that experience if everything had gone perfectly.
Yeah. I'm a short distance guy, but I've done 2 24-hour PR attempts, 24-hour solo road. And I spent hours being lost each time. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh, screw that. And my third one, I just did 50-mile loops from my house. So, okay. Well, I think it's your turn to ask a question. Then I'm up next.
I think it's kind of fascinating that we've had similar issues, but you know, kind of opposite trajectory and timings with them. I'm pretty certain that, you know, mine is, issues have been, you know, brain chemistry. So it's nature as far as nurture. Whereas for you, you've had a different upbringing, you know, much more challenging childhood situation. And I'm wondering how you see your issues with addiction, and whether it's, you know, you look at it in terms of the nature versus nurture as to what pushed you or led you down that road.
It's a fascinating question, mostly because I haven't thought about it. I just went and did it, both the addiction, the drug abuse, and then quitting, and then 5 other addictions after that. And I'm in one of them right now, you know? So it's a place where I'm surprised I haven't gone there yet in my head, but nature nurture. So nature grabbed me and pulled me in, but when I smoked that first joint when I was 13 and couldn't stop for 13 years, and I had to do everything all the way to coke, heroin, and meth in my arm, in my fingers, in my feet with a needle. I don't know. It's, you know, you said earlier, you were talking about safety and you were talking about relationships and your girlfriend at the time having your back. And you felt safe, like it's okay. And so that drops your anxiety and it doesn't create additional cortisol and mess you up worse. I've been involved in, I started 2 nonprofits, well, co-founded the second. And it's an early education and childcare center for children that are experiencing homelessness. And our curriculum basically states that there's 3 levels. Number one, in order for the kid to be healthy, happy, and alive, first of all, they need to feel safe, period. Mm-hmm. Period. And then once they feel safe, then they need to feel love or connection. And then they can learn, and then you can talk to them, and then you can talk about their behavior. But if they don't feel safe or loved, you lose them. And so it's funny, I know that. From this nonprofit, the Plainfield Madison over on Mineral Point Road near Hilldale. But I think it's because I didn't feel safe. My father told me that he loved me every time I saw him, but he was busy, and sometimes he was screaming at us. You know, he raised four kids by himself in 1969. That's a tall order. Social services showed up to take us away and he kicked them out. But my mom was gone and my dad was busy. And I grew up in Baltimore City and a lot of shit was flying around. I think I was having nightmares about my mother when I was younger. And she was locked up for a long time. She didn't get out till I was a teenager. But everything seemed uncertain. There was nothing that I felt like was protecting me.
How old were you again when your mom really spiraled?
Well, I was five when she was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. And she spent a year and a half in and out of mental hospitals. And then when I was seven, she got committed to a state mental institution lockdown. Goodbye, throw away the key kind of thing. And that was it. My dad got divorced from her and he raised us. My mother never came back. So that was a loss, you know? That was a loss, John. It was a loss just like my first wife. It was a loss just like my second wife. It was a loss, self-imposed loss, when I quit my job at Trek. It's a loss. And there's sorrow. And there's an emptiness and there's a hole. And I was too young to be able to articulate the pain and the loss and the sorrow of my mom is gone. I know I have a lot of friends of mine who grew up without a father, but the only people who I know who grew up without a mother were the ones that were adopted and they had an adoptive mother. So I think there's a hole. I think there's an emotional hole that we get riddled with. It's like a machine gun. We get all these holes poked through us. But I would have to think about this more, but maybe it's just the void of no mom, no mother. And for a year and a half, she was a basket case, just crying and talking, saying my dad was the devil and somebody's mm-hmm. going to kill us. But we were too young and we were just running around having fun. So I think at the base of my drug addiction was it just made me feel good and it allowed me to escape. But, you know, when I first smoked pot, I was like, what's next? And then we were doing mushrooms, psychedelic mushrooms within a few weeks. And then we were doing amphetamine speed. And then we were doing the barbiturates. And once we started doing the barbiturates, it was game over. Because you can't shake that stuff. And then you build up a tolerance, you know. Quaaludes were one of the most famous kind of barbiturate street drugs back in the day, and they make you feel good. But when you're eating four or five of them at a time, you can't even see straight. And then the cocaine started early, but then it was, you know, we'd freebase it and turn it into crack and smoke it. And the first night I smoked crack, I was like, wow, that's amazing. What's next? Anybody got any needles? And there it was. It was a downward spiral. But I think it was the uncertainty and the loss and the void at home. But I don't think I just realized that until 50 years later.
I find it interesting, and I think this is, you know, a sign of emotional health. Most people would blame their childhood. Like, that's an easy target. It's like, oh yeah, I became a drug addict because my mom had mental health issues. And you don't seem to do that.
I'm not trying to do it. I chose to be a drug addict. Right. I chose to shove that needle in my arm. And then I also chose to quit. And then for the rest of my life, I've pretty much chosen to try to say yes to everything when shit comes along. It's like a Jim Carrey movie, The Yes Man. Yep, I'll do it, you know? Sure. And just it lines up. But I own it. I own all of it. I have two amazing ex-wives, and I played a huge part in that, at least 51%, you know, but I don't blame anything. I just roll with it because it is what it is. First of all, I can't change it. Second of all, if I just blame, then I'm not discovering truth, because blame is not truth.
It doesn't do you any good. It makes you feel good in the moment.
Yeah. And so I dig for truth. And my truth is that it was a challenging situation, but there's hundreds of millions, arguably billions of people that had it much worse than me, like by far. And they're happy as a clam. So what's my fucking excuse? I don't have one. So I just roll with it.
It's a good, healthy way to live.
Well, you know, it's hard. No matter which way you try to live, healthy or otherwise, you know, those challenges keep coming no matter what. So speaking of challenges, I mean, you've seemed to be able to just keep plowing forward in life despite some major challenges. How do you put up with yourself during recovery of some of the injuries you've had?
It's always been that way. And I would say, like, I have had some serious setbacks. And at the same time, I have gotten so gosh darn lucky, it's not even fathomable in other ways. And they've balanced out. And I'd say overall, like, I've been way more fortunate. When I started running in high school, got injured. I spent 3 years going to doctors. I couldn't run at all. They couldn't find what was wrong with me. Like, my right leg went dead. Like, it didn't hurt and it wasn't numb. It was dead. It just didn't work quite right. And especially then, like, doctors don't like that. Like, they want to fix your ACL or your tennis elbow or whatever it is. And so they weren't even all that curious, which I would have thought. It's like, oh, here's a guy with a problem we've never seen before. Isn't this fascinating? And they were more along the lines of, you know, if it bothers you to run, stop running. That was the answer I got from the very first doctor. And then 3 years later, that was the answer I got from the last one I went to. It's like, we don't know. You know, if it bothers you to run, do something else.
Was that injury when you were in Madison running cross country, was that a muscle mobility thing? Was it a...
Well, it related to sciatica. So I've always had, you know, major problems with sciatica, and even can't remember what year, but like 95, I had sciatica release surgery, which was a huge mistake. Like I wouldn't do that again, but it was recommended to me by another athlete, but it messed me up for a super long time. Like, my left leg was numb for a year after that, which didn't go well when you're trying to ride your bike for a living. I quit running, which that was my whole kind of, you know, world was based on running. So I had to kind of rethink things. But then I started riding my bike. What happened? Oh, I got Giardia that knocked me out for 6 months or a year. It was like having mono. Like, I was not the same person for a super long time, which is funny. Like, back to Vail, I think I got it from Vail tap water. And the guys that I rode with, the Frisco guys, we would stop at the Vail, you know, Safeway or grocery store, and just fill up with water and, you know, have a snack and be on our way. And they would all buy bottled water. You know, I thought that was pretty snobby. It's like, bottled water? Why don't you just get, there's a drinking fountain right there. Why don't you get that? And they're like, you know, Vail's got a reputation for letting some Giardia through their municipal water. And I'm like,
Mexico.
I'm like, this is Vail, Colorado. How can the water not be good? But that's where I think I got it. Like, I wasn't drinking stream water then. I had no exposure. But so I'd lost a year of riding. I didn't race that next summer. And then I was out in LA for a Ram qualifier and the trade show, Interbike. And I went for a ride up into the San Gabriels. And on my way back down, I got mugged. I got hit in the head with a brick and left for dead. Got a compound skull fracture. 30 years later, I still have a hole, you know, in my skull. Wasn't wearing a helmet back then.
Lovely.
And I wasn't the same after that for, you know, about 6 months. So that took some while to recover from. And then, you know, like as older, I've had injuries, but none of those were, you know, just the usual stuff, like crash. And I'm sure you've hit your head numerous times.
30.
Did you ever have concussion problems? I know, like, at least in my experience, concussion diagnosis really wasn't a thing back then.
Well, I've been diagnosed with neurocognitive disorder as a result of the concussions.
Really?
I had over 30 concussions, 9 major concussions, where I either lost consciousness, lost my vision, or lost memory, or a combination of that. One time I lost my vision when I was conscious for half an hour. Scary as hell.
That is brutal.
one of my doctors is convinced I have CTE, and it's a little handicapping at the moment, but I'm working around it. It was part of what blew up my second marriage. As I was planning my own suicide. So no wonder there.
When did that become known to you, that you were having brain issues related to crashes?
It started 5 years ago, but it really flared up 3 years ago. You know, I had two major face on a rock moments. Mm-hmm. One in
Those at Mount Snow.
Mount Snow 94 in the rock garden. Me and Bob Roll were going back and forth, and I'd pass him on the downhills and he'd pass me in the uphills, and I was trying to beat him at the line because it's freaking Bob Roll.
Right.
And I got way ahead of myself at that rock garden place where thousands of people, East Coasters, were all screaming for me to beat Bob. And I'm face first on a rock, broke my jaw, lost a bunch of teeth, spent 6 months laid up at home. Mm-hmm. Major, well, not major brain injury, but it was a traumatic brain injury. So, but you roll with it. My question was that when, you know, between 30 concussions and 13 surgeries and 40 broken bones, I've had to be laid up at home every once in a while. And, you know, do you effectively make it through those periods where you're laid up, or is your brain going crazy and you're like a caged animal?
No, I think I always took a very pragmatic view of injuries. The stereotype of the athlete is, you know, you've got to, you know, restrain them, you know, to keep them from hurting themselves, you know, getting back at it, you know, too soon. And, you know, while I had those same compulsions to, like, nobody wants to waste time and lose training time, like you drive yourself crazy thinking you're losing fitness when you're probably not. But I always thought, if you really look at it, you're so much better off just heal completely. Just take the time, heal completely. Every time you try and come back too soon, you irritate something, and then it causes a delay.
You screw it up. Yeah, we're dumb animals, many of us.
Yeah, so I think, you know, maybe I didn't, you know that early on, but the older and the wiser I got, you know, any injury, just wait until it's better. And then start. I think in hindsight, you know, looking back on, you know, athletic career, I would have taken a lot more time off. I was always paranoid about even taking a week off, like for a vacation or for, you know, end of season, and thinking, oh my God, I'm going to lose all of my fitness, you know, if I don't train. And the reality is, like, no, you can have an injury, you can lose a few months, and then you're not going to come back instantly, but you're going to be fine. You don't lose fitness. It was nearly as fast as you think.
Yeah, it would have allowed a lot of other recovery to happen.
Well, no, and I think I would have performed better if I had rested more. Like, I think the biggest mistake I made in training was overtraining. You know, I did too much. I should have taken more breaks. I used to run with Scott Jurek, you know, the ultra runner, and you know, we'd talk about a lot of stuff. And I think he would take a month off every off season. And I was flabbergasted at that. When I was in my racing days, I would not have been able to take a month off. I would have been convinced that I would never achieve peak form ever again. And it's just not true. You can, you know, and I think that healing time is way undervalued. I think you need your brain and your body need time to heal and recover,
yeah,
you know, and then work back into it.
I don't agree. I'm not trying to challenge you, but I don't agree with the overtraining term. I think it's under recovery, which is what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I can, you know, I can train on my butt, like Floyd, you know, Floyd used to, like, he's like, oh, I'm riding 600 miles a week, you know, and blah, 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 and riding wheelies around all of us. But, you know, to me, it's just under recovery. And, you know, with my Nordic ski racing, I know you were a skier too. But I was doing 5 marathon races a year, you know, Berkey distance races. Mm-hmm. And it adds up fast. And I've met some amazing people through Nordic skiing. And one guy, Zach Caldwell up in Vermont, just mad scientist of a ski coach guy. He's like, 3 days hard, 2 days off. 3 days hard, 2 days off. I'm like, I would never take 2 days off, like ever. I just train, because it's exactly what you said. I'm going to lose something. But anyway, I have a question. What's been the biggest regret of your life?
Number one for sure is failed second marriage for my kids and losing that, you know, tight unit to, you know, watch them, you know, grow up and be a team. I really regret that by far more than anything. And then, you know, kind of a close second and very related is just losing, you know, 10 years of my life basically to being an alcoholic. Because, you know, one day was the same as, you know, every other day. And that was like, you know, it was just a waste. I meant to like, because you're only here for so long. And especially if you want to be athletic, like you only have so many years, although, you know, that old age limit keeps increasing. Like, I don't feel bad at all at age 55, but, you know, I could have had some, you know, really fun adventures, you know, these past few years. And, you know, I chose to throw that away.
I count them down. I have 670 weekends left in my life.
That's awesome.
Good ones anyway. You know, because of all my orthopedic and neurocognitive injuries, I'm kind of writing myself off athletically at 70. So, and it helps me. That number helps me because I'm just like, what am I doing today to make a difference in my life and in other people's lives? Like, I'm not going to sit around. I'm not going to waste this day. I'm not going to waste this week. I'm not going to waste this month. I'm not going to waste this year. And it's hard. It's
How are your like arthritis, knees and hips?
Knock on wood, I'm fine. My problem area is my shoulders. But I can still Nordic ski, you know? I'm up here. You know, I can, you know, bang away at the poles. So I've had 6 rotator cuff surgeries and 10 broken collarbones, and it adds up. But knees and hips and back and neck and knock on wood, I dodged that bullet.
Yeah, a lot of folks our age, you know, haven't. And like they're hitting the end of their athletic career, you know, now. Yeah, because, you know, they're having hip replacements and you don't just get one hip replacement, you know, those don't last very long. And I see, you know, folks I know on Facebook and they're getting knee replacements, you know, in their mid 50s and knees don't last for forever. So I'm thankful mine are decent. My hips are perfect. And I went to a doctor a number of years ago because I was having problems in my knees. And she said it was arthritic and that the sides of my knees are pretty much worn out, but vertically, they're really good. Hmm. She said you'll never need a knee replacement.
Yeah. Most people I know that have those kind of degenerative problems are not athletes, right? Like Mike Eatoff, Chris's dad, he's been through the ringer because he's raced downhill and motocross his whole life and all that. But most people I know, you know, it's the sitting around that does you in. But who knows? Just keep going until you go. I mean, 2 weeks ago, I did 248 miles in 19 hours. So I'm not dead yet.
No, you've got, how old are you?
56, just a year older than you. Yeah. I got 14 years.
I think you have to give yourself more than 14 years. You've got more to do. And I think 70 is a low number.
Yeah, maybe, but it's the neurocognitive functionality.
Oh.
And the fact that I've had so many breaks and bones and whatever, but who knows? So what's in your way of having your best life now? What's the barrier or what's the roadblock for you doing everything you want to do at this point, John?
I don't think that there is anything. You know, I need to jumpstart things and get going. But in a general sense, like on a day-to-day basis, you know, as happy as I've ever been.
And you're certainly healthy.
I feel super healthy. I don't have any complaints. Maybe the main reason I'm happy, for a number of years, I didn't get any satisfaction from the little things in life. And I think that's part of the whole drug addict cycle. You don't get, you know, your dopamine hit from little things. So you have to keep increasing and you have to do the bigger and better things, or not better, but more extreme. And I think, you know, that's obviously a dangerous cycle to be in. And I think now I just like, you know, cooking. Like I've never enjoyed food that I cook now more than I have. Like it's not fuel. It's like I just relish not just spinach, but good spinach and good olive oil and just the little things that I do, making my tortillas and putting salt in the pan before I, you know, put them down.
And the process of cooking. Like I just hired a new nutritionalist and I've made more dirty dishes in the last week than I have in the last year. And I think the cooking itself, just being in the kitchen, is like therapy. It's so satisfying.
Yeah. So I'm happy. And that's a really important start for me because I wasn't for a long time. And you can't really go anywhere if you're not happy.
Well, you've worked very hard and you're the world professional on bouncing back from stuff and facing stuff. So that's awesome.
Keep plugging away. How do you prevent your kids from repeating, you know, some of these, you know, addiction behaviors or patterns? How do you insulate them from that? Like, I mean, you're in control of the nurture part of the equation, but they've got your same chemistry. So in some ways, as with me, they're at least predisposed if the situation arises. And like, just wondering, you are very thoughtful. Seems like that would be a priority for you to make sure that doesn't happen.
It's the number one priority in my life. And if I could assure that they're not going to suffer from addiction or suffer emotional pain, you can cut off my arms and legs right now. You can cut off my head. I don't care. That's my only purpose. That's my only true meaning. That's going to be my legacy when I'm gone. The only thing that anybody's going to talk about Roger Bird is about his kids and what they're doing. So what I try to do, first of all, I can't keep them from becoming addicts, period. But I try not to insulate them from anything. So when my daughter was 8 and my son was 10, I sat him down at the kitchen table for 3 hours and explained what pot was and what Molly was and what heroin is and what needles are and what pills are. And we had the full education. They got a PhD in drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And my 8-year-old daughter is like, Daddy, did you ever do that? I was like, I did all of it. I overdosed twice. I used to sell it. I was a drug addict. I was a drug dealer. I would stand in the parking lot of the high school and sell grams of anything you wanted. And they're like, oh my gosh, you know? And I think that has helped. My son at UW, University of Wisconsin, arguably the number one party school in the country, so says US News and World Reports, or maybe they're the second, but he doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke pot. He doesn't do cocaine. Because I told him, I was like, there is a very high probability you will be a drug addict the very first time you taste anything. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of people that do drugs for the first time and they're dead that night. Same with alcohol.
Right.
They drink themselves into a coma the first time they ever taste it. And so I'm in a very little safe, vibrant community over here, east side of Madison, Cottage Grove, you know where that is. And it seems like a lot of the parents, they're not being honest with their kids. They're not saying, oh, I've suffered from depression, or I was a drug addict when I was a kid, and 2 years ago, I tried to kill myself. And there's none of that.
Right.
But I don't hide from that. And to me, if I did, it would be a lie. And I'm not going to lie to my kids, period. I might not always tell them the truth, but I'll tell them. I was like, you're not old enough to understand that, or it's none of your business, or I'm just not going to tell you. Or I'll tell you when you're 18, which is one of the things I told them a long time ago about something. But I try to expose them to everything, John, and I try to give them the tough love that there's a good chance that when me and your mom die, and that's the hardest hit you ever face in life, that you turn to a bottle or you turn to drugs. And if you do that, you might not ever come back. And all the people that you're looking down on and maybe even judging now, you might be one of them shortly. You never know. Mm-hmm. So to me, I put it on the table. And I try to talk to my damn kids. You know, my son, you know, I know you were taking psychology. You were on that path at Madison, but my son takes some psychology stuff. He's comp sci, but we have these really deep conversations and I'm brutally honest with my daughter. And you know what, if something bad is going on, I get involved. I don't necessarily try to fix it, but I'm just like, I am here. And we are doing this together. and not necessarily telling them what they have to do, but trying to help them not make it worse and do stupid shit. It's a hard job. It's a hard job. I have a niece who's a junkie right now in Baltimore. You know, I have four sets of parents that I am working with and counseling, and their kids are drug addicts and or suffering from poor mental health. And it's brutal. My most favorite sister in the world, just a year younger than me, she lost her daughter to her poor mental health. And there's more coming. So I just try to face reality and I plow right down the middle. You know, I don't try to hide the fact of where I came from and what I learned. And more than anything, I try to tell them, this will affect you probably worse than you ever could imagine. And it might even kill you first night. And I'd rather not lose you. So I'm going to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. So that's my technique.
Educate them and then pray.
Well, and you know what? Be a fucking asshole when I need to be an asshole. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I don't feel good. Why don't I come down and see you? Oh, no, it's okay. Okay, I'm going to be outside of your house in a half an hour, banging on your door at midnight. And if you don't come out and go to Ian's Pizza with me on State Street, I'm not going to give up. I'm not quitting on you.
Right.
It got tough with me when I was a teenager. My dad let me go. Do whatever you want to do. I'm not doing that to my kids. One of them might die today. I can't necessarily stop that, but there are some things I can do, and I'll put that in front of everything else forever. I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. What's been the scariest moment of your life?
Scariest moment? Got a couple. I was doing Montezuma's Revenge one year out in Colorado. I don't remember what year, 90, 95. Well, they all blend together now. But that year it had been a super heavy snow year. And in Montezuma's Revenge, you know, it's a loop, multiple different loop race. And one of the loops, you know, based in the town of Montezuma by Keystone, you ride your bike up to about 12,000 feet. And then from 12 to 14, you know, you hike off trail and then you hike back down to 12 on the other side of a ridge, hop back on your bike and, you know, get back into town. And there'd been a ton of snow. So everybody was thinking snowshoes, but then like the day before the race, it got super cold and everything froze up. So going up like 2000 vertical feet, I was trying to kick in side steps in my Shimano cycling shoes on close to ice, you know, snow conditions. And luckily I was doing it in the dark and, you know, there was cloud cover. So I couldn't see anything, but it would have been super scary because I was just going up the side, you know, of a steep mountain and barely getting any purchase, you know, like you had to double check each step before you made your next step. Otherwise you'd just slide down a really long ways. So I make it up and I start coming down and I'm trying to, you know, kick in heel steps. And I slip. And so I start, and I'm wearing, you know, it's cold. It's maybe 20 degrees or something. You know, I'm wearing nylon wind pants and a nylon jacket on basically ice on a, you know, steep slope. So I'm sliding.
You're a sled.
Yeah, I am a sled. And then yeah, I see my bike, you know, kind of veers off from me and I'm flailing. And I have nothing to, you know, stop myself. And I know that ahead of me, there's a cornice. And on the other side of that cornice is like, it's 1,500 feet into a pile of rocks, you know, in the basin below. So that's one of the few times I've ever thought, oh, like I could be dead here. Like if I don't, you know, stop or divert my path, like I'm going to be just a bag of broken bones at the bottom of this thing. But I just pure luck, I got veered. I think there's a rock sticking out or something, but, you know, was able to, you know, stop myself. My bike is out on the edge of the, you know, cornice. So I have to go get that. And it took me a while to, you know, kind of get my nerve back together. But that was like in terms of like being really scared in the moment, that's probably the most scared I've been. I mean, I've been charged by moose up in Alaska. That's a little scary. I once, again, in Alaska at the Iditarod. This is like 2 days in and I'm out on the Farewell Burn, which is kind of a barren landscape place. And it was really cold. It was probably 20 degrees below zero. And I was really fatigued. I remember it was kind of rolly, and then I sunk down into this basin. And as I sunk down into that basin, the air was so much colder, it was almost paralyzing, you know, to me. And I just thought, you know, I can't, like, I've got to crawl in my sleeping bag. Like, I'm not functioning, you know, right. So I pulled up my bag and I crawled in, and I would never do this again, you know, but you kind of learn these lessons the hard way. Even though I had a minus 40 degree sleeping bag, like I had the best sleeping bag technology could make, but that sleeping bag was at minus 30 something. So as you crawl into that, it just, and if you're borderline hypothermic, it just sucks the last little bit of heat out of you. So then I started physically convulsing, like not like little muscle cramps, but like whole body cramps. I was super nervous. And I thought, you know what, if I stay in the sleeping bag, like, and I fall asleep, I won't wake up.
You're dead. Yeah.
So I pulled, like, and it's not easy to, you know, get yourself, you know, packed up. But I was like, I got to do it. I remembered I had passed a buffalo hunter's camp not too far behind me. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to pack up and I'm going to go back to that hunter's camp. And hopefully there's somebody there. Or if not, you know, I'll use their stuff and make a fire or something. And there was. And, you know, I ended up being up fine. I, you know, froze some toes, but no worse for wear. But if I had stayed in that bivy and, you know, slept, you know, I probably would have only been okay if somebody had come along and found me. But like, those days, like, nobody's, there's no Garmin in reach. Nobody's looking for you.
Yeah.
Good and bad. Like, you know, the good part of that is it's incredibly satisfying to extract yourself from a dangerous situation. Like, it's a really, it's an incredible feeling that you really, you can't get very many places. And the self-dependence of, you know, having a potentially bad outcome and, you know, no help, you kind of do it by yourself and you fix it. I don't, that's part of the reason that I, you know, did kind of all of those events was, you know, that the negative situations, you know, you wouldn't want to do them every day. Like, it's not something you would actively seek out, but when they happen and you overcome them, it's a great sense of accomplishment. You know, it's not about, I mean, winning is great. And you know, I was super fortunate to be able to do, you know, plenty of that. But the reason I did those, that entire sport was that satisfaction of overcoming challenges and all the things that are put in your path and relying on yourself and, you know, your lifetime of knowledge to get yourself out of it.
Yeah. You're here and you didn't die. Yay me. Yeah.
It takes a lot. It's hard to get snuffed out. At the same time, what's the blanking on the name now? The Angel, is it Jack London story, short story of the guy who falls in the creek and then starts a fire and to build a fire. So it's, you know, it starts with one little slip up and then it just starts cascading. Like he gets a fire going and then, but it heats up the tree that's full of snow and the snow puts his fire out. And it's like one little error just has a butterfly effect and it starts to cascade. And then before you know it, you're toast.
Yeah. It takes a lot to snuff yourself out, but we sure walked that line. I've been dangling over that edge a few times and wow, but here we are. Thank goodness. Well, I'm glad you've made it through all those challenging moments.
Makes me stronger.
Yeah. Okay, your turn.
Did you ever see doping in cycling?
No. No, I did not. When I was racing, so I raced mountain bikes for 17 years and I raced professionally for 9 years, 9 of those 17. I never saw it. I was not racing with top level pros on my team. It was more regional. You know, I race for Fisher. I race for Schwinn. I race for Reflex. I race for Cannondale. I race for Trek. I race for Nuke Proof. And, you know, I was always the B pro. So I never saw it. The closest I ever got to it was just talking to Floyd about it. Long after all that shit shook out, like 4 years ago, hanging out with him in Leadville.
Yeah, I never saw it either. And, you know, part of the reason I bring it up is I listen to a lot of these interviews with athletes, and it always irritates me if the subject is never broached because it's the elephant in the room. I think it was such a big part of the sport in some areas of the sport that it's important to have a pretty good house cleaning of it. I never saw it. I never had to say no. I was never offered it. I would like to think, I mean, I know through a certain point, I would have 100% quit the sport if I had to choose between continuing on or doping. I was totally self-righteous. I for sure would have said, there's other things I can do. I don't need to do this. You know, after I was married and had a kid, I would like to think I still would have, you know, said that same thing, but it's kind of hypocritical for me to say, oh, I wouldn't have doped if I didn't ever have that chance. It's easy, you know, it's easy to say in hindsight, which you wouldn't have done. But for the guys who did dope, you know, they were in a different situation. Like at the time with Floyd, I would have said, if there's one clean pro in the
no
world,
way. Yeah.
I'd say, if there's one guy who's clean, it's Floyd.
No
and I
way.
Would have bet my life just knowing him as a Mennonite kid. We gave him his first drink of Mountain Dew. The kid had never had Mountain Dew at 24 hours of snowshoe.
He never watched TV. One of the trivial pursuit questions in the motorhome to Moab was, what was the dinosaur's name on the Flintstones? He's like, what's the Flintstones? He was like, pure.
He wouldn't have goo energy gel. He's like, I'm not touching that. I don't know what all's in. I'm not going anywhere near.
Right.
I'm not going near goo. And then so like that was a loss of innocence for me. It's like, oh, well, if Floyd doped, I don't believe anything's clean.
Yeah, but there are guys. I mean, there's a kid from Baltimore that Jeremiah Bishop, you know, that guy is clean. I'll bet my life on that one too. But he has limited his success because of his beliefs of staying clean. And he is married with kids, but he kept that high road. And he's not going to finish racing with some big retirement account like he could have otherwise, but he's staying true to his values. And I talked to Floyd about that. That's a tough, I don't know if I want to go way down that road right now, but he was in a tough spot. I know Lance enough that Floyd didn't feel like he could get out of that tough spot at the moment.
Oh, I don't think he did. And I, you know, as much as
he didn't, no, he didn't.
As much as I say, you know, my position, it's a totally different world to be a Euro pro, know that everybody else is doing it. And like, it's you do it or you go home, you give up your career. That's not an easy thing to do. I mean, I fault the sport. I don't necessarily fault, you know, the folks. I think it's totally unfair that some of those guys, you know, are still total heroes and are still making gobs of money. Whereas Floyd is kind of a pariah. Like, you know, it's totally unfair into who was the villain and who was the redeemer. It's just a crazy, crazy world. And it's harder for me to enjoy the sport now.
Yeah. I don't even watch it. I didn't even know they were having the Tour de France this year till they were a week in. And I'm like, are they doing it virtually? And they're like, no, they're doing the race. And I'm like, I hope Chris Froome doesn't win. Like, I didn't even know.
They were riding 7 watts a kilogram up the climbs. They were setting climbing records.
Yeah. Are you kidding me? Right.
Climbing records this year. So like, that's disappointing. It's just, you know, I don't have an answer. Like, I don't think it's going to go away. There's no, you can't just wish it would be different. But it's too bad because I would love to follow the sport. I would love to be able to believe in, you know, athletic performance because I think there's great stories there and it makes it challenging.
But you know what's funny? How many older guys are doping? And even in these Grand Fondos, like they're drug testing in Grand Fondos because a lot of these older guys, they want to stay fast and they have the money and there's doping everywhere.
Yeah, that's why I say I'm disillusioned, you know, even in the ultra scene. Again, I've never seen it. I have no person to, you know, ever accuse of doing anything, but it would be naive to think that it wasn't, you know, there, at least in certain, you know, time frames, years wise. And then you see it like the age groupers in California, you know, are getting popped. And I think that one, what was it, that marathon runner, like a 70-year-old woman marathon runner, I think recently got popped for doping. So, I mean, that's disappointing. The other side of that, you know, speaking of, you know, older, you know, athletes, these father-son just set the record for fastest marathon father-son. Like after I started riding my bike last summer, I kind of started looking into, it's like, well, all right, I'm 55. Like, can you even be fast, you know, at 55? And I'm like, you know, don't know. Like I'm curious as to what changes, you know, go on, you know, with your body. And this 50, yeah, he was 55. Oh, and he was just not, he was a former 216 marathoner, I think. So like a fast guy.
Wow.
But then he sat on the couch for 10 years. So he wasn't just older, but I mean, he did a full, you know, couch sit for a decade. And he came back and he ran like a 220, really good, like very fast. I think the human potential for older people is far greater than we've ever given it credit for. Like, I would have thought there would be more people like you and I who, you know, kind of raced back in the day and then, you know, either took, you know, like a couple decades off because of kids or professional career or, you know, whatever it may be. But by your mid-50s, you know, your kids are probably at least teenagers or, you know, maybe you're an empty nester. It seems like a lot of those folks would, they'd kind of revisit the, you know, competition scene. And so far, I haven't seen that. Like, you see, be really competitive up to age 50, like 5-0, like people do something big, like Leadville on their 50th. But then after age 51, it does a nosedive. And I'm curious as to why that is.
I don't know.
Like, there's a market in those events for those, that customer, and I don't see them there.
You would think, because you have the time. Well, not that you always have the time, because some people keep striving in that corporate success rat race chase for a long time.
But probably more time and money than you did when you were 30.
Yeah, and you have the opportunity. And like you said, kids are growing up and you might have even gone through a divorce and struggling with a little bit of mental health and time to get back on the bike.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. It's crazy. I need to ask you a question about Alaska real quick. I do a lot of winter sports, and between my fat biking and my Nordic skiing, you know, I'm out there doing it in negative 20 and stuff. And I heat up and I sweat and I get wet. When you're doing those long IDITA sports, did you keep your effort lower so you weren't sweating? Or how did you handle all of that body temperature regulation and wet clothes?
You know, wet is death. And like the bulk of the 90s, when I was doing it, clothing companies didn't make products for that circumstance. Gore-Tex sent me, you know, some of their first generation Gore-Tex, you know, like chopper's mitts, you know, the pile liner and the Gore mitts. And they sent some to me to use up in Alaska. And they swore, you know, these won't freeze up. And I used them, and I think I had to chuck them at like the first checkpoint or something, because they, they froze rock solid. Like, I mean, my hands were still warm. They were insulated, but like they were in the curve of my handlebar and, you know, I couldn't do much with them. And I remember I talked to their engineers, you know, afterwards, and they're like, well, we can't understand, you know, how any moisture, you know, could have gotten in there. Like, they just didn't, even the engineers at Gore didn't understand the dynamics of moisture. And yeah, it's inside. And then, you know, you get moisture trapped between the layers, like between the DWR coating on the outside and the membrane. Because you can't dry that. If water gets in there, you can't dry that. It's nearly impossible. And then so for active wear, like I had to, you know, either make or customize a lot of the stuff that I used for years. And it, like, I got a good education on, you know, what worked and what didn't. And then I eventually got partnered with Patagonia, because they were the first company to start doing like endurance specific outerwear. And I did product development and athlete stuff for them for about 10 years, that 2000 to 2010 when I was trail running. And that was really fun. And they were really invested in making products that worked for athletes, period. Make it work, use good materials, figure out the selling parts, you know, later. I was really impressed with, you know, their marketing spin wasn't just marketing spin. It was core, you know, to the company. And now, like, there's tons of companies that do that. You can get really good clothing from, you know, dozens of companies. But back around 2000, like, you're trying to, you know, adapt ski, you know, downhill ski clothing to performance, you know, in endurance sports. You build up so much heat that what you have to wear cycling, even at 20 below, is, it's far less than anyone would think. It's just a, you know, a basically a jersey type weight top, and then a windproof, you know, top over that. And as long as you're moving, you know, you'll stay comfortable. And as soon as you stop, like, you can't stop.
Yeah. I mean, I get soaking wet in my ski races. I'll have icicles hanging off my headband because, you know, I'm just sweating away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Moisture management is the whole ball game.
Did you have spare clothes for stops? Did you have drop bags that I did a sport?
Like, the first couple of years they did that. But then, you know, after we started going to McGrath, it became much more extreme and you're kind of on your own. So what you started with was what you were going to finish with. And so that made those decisions, you know, a lot more critical. You know, and if you did get into a problem, you'd either have to find a cabin and thaw it out, dry it out over the stove. You know, that was your only option. So it made, you know, that gear choice really critical. was pretty, I didn't have too many clothing disasters. I really spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about it. It was a little challenging doing that from Cincinnati, Ohio. We would get a few weeks of cold weather. Couldn't ride on snow. It was, you know, I'd go for a road ride at 15 degrees, but a road ride at 15 degrees is really cold.
Super cold. Yeah. Cool. All right.
You know, you might not have an answer to this. I'm more curious. Do you have any traits, you know, and we sort of touched on this earlier, any traits that, you know, you saw in your addiction life that you see very visible in your non-addiction life, but, you know, went from, you know, totally counterproductive, you know, something that leads you down the bad path as an addict, but that same trait is a net positive attribute outside of that?
I think the way I would try to answer that is, it was a journey to understand the human experience top to bottom. When somebody overdoses right in front of you, when somebody has a gun sitting next to them at all times, when people get locked up in federal prison, when people get murdered over a bag of dope, when somebody ODs and other people jump in trying to save their life, and when you realize there's no way out, seeing that some people have the resolve to get out, it was a powerful lesson. It was an experience I'm glad I had, because it gave me an education that I would have got. I would have never gotten that lesson anywhere else. Still, never. You don't see that. I mean, some people do, but a lot of us live in a very safe world. And I think another big part of it was I got to see the worst of myself, the very worst. What am I willing to do? And there's a whole nother level of worse, but that was worse enough. That was bad enough, you know? Right. But I think it's just the gamut of experience. When life or death is marginalized, it's like, oh, he died today, or life was much more fragile during those years. And it was also a lesson of hustle, and it was a lesson of business, and it was a lesson of communication, and it was a lesson of how much can you take? Mm-hmm. You know, if you've been awake for 3 days doing cocaine, what does that feel like? You know, so, but I think it's seeing the best in people and seeing the worst in people and finding the best and worst in yourself, because you don't have a choice. You know, once you're a junkie, you don't always make it out of that. And especially nowadays with all the fentanyl and the carfentanil, which is, you know, 10 times more powerful than fentanyl, it's just, you're dead. You're just dead. Mm-hmm. Like, as a paramedic, you better wear gloves, because if you even touch a little salt grain size of powder of carfentanil, you're dead. Just dead.
You may or may not know this, but I'm curious. It seemed like with all the opioid overdoses, it's not in the drug dealer's interest to have your customers overdose. So why?
Yeah, it is.
Why? Don't you want them to, you know, stay on and keep purchasing? You lose a customer if they OD.
I talked about this a little bit in one of the episodes, but what happens is, as an addict, you build up such a tolerance, you're not getting high anymore, especially if you're on heroin, right, if you're on dope.
Trying to function.
All you're doing is you're starving off the sickness. And so you're not even getting high. And so you're wanting to get high, but more than anything, you're just trying not to be sick. And it's different with cocaine and a little different with methamphetamine. But when somebody overdoses, that means that it's strong stuff. Okay. That's what it used to mean back in the day before the fentanyl, because now it's just poison. But if it's strong stuff, then you're likely to get a hold of that, and you might even get high, you know, for several years. I was trying to get high. I was trying to get high, shoving that needle in my arm. I wasn't getting high at all.
Right.
Except for just doing the cocaine, which is come and gone instantly. But you rush across town. It's like there's a, you know, we used to call it a bad batch. Now it is a bad batch because it's fentanyl and carfentanil. But the quality of the product varies greatly. And sometimes you get a really strong batch and that's what you want, and you run towards it. So a lot of that overdose death, even when you get 10 people who die off the same batch in one day, there's still 100 people running for it the next day.
That's the evil power of it.
Well, it's the evil power, because you're just, you want to get high again, and you haven't gotten high in years, you know? And the very first shot of cocaine I did in a needle, I ended up, you know, getting to the point where I could shoot 3 or 4 times that any day of the week, except when it was super strong. And that's what kills people. And that's what caused my 2 overdoses, is I hit a strong patch. Mm-hmm. And instead of doing, you know, 0.3 gram of stuff that's cut or watered down, filler material has been added, it was strong. And you go into cardiac arrest. So what are you going to do then? You better pray you got some good people around you, you know? And I mean, now everybody's carrying the Narcan shots and the sprays, you know, whatever. Some of those guys, you know, you got to give them 2 or 3 shots to get them back. It's ridiculous. You know, I have a family member who is a paramedic in Baltimore, and he was man on the street, saving heroin junkies every single day. Some days that's all they did. No car accidents, no domestic violence, just junkies ODing all day long. So it's wild, man. It's a wild, wild world. I got a question for you. Define addiction.
Fascinating subject. I would almost, you know, I would start with, you know, a passionate reliance on something. You know, it's almost a semantics argument of addiction versus passion. It can go either way. And addiction has a very negative connotation. It's usually seen, you know, with the downsides. You can take one activity that can be construed as either an addiction or a passion, like even my kind of extreme cycling, that could be viewed as an addiction from folks who don't know. And I could make an argument that tons of things about it, my compulsion to do it, lots of different factors were an addiction, whereas I saw it as an awesome passion. And I think tons of people can drink alcohol and get incredible enjoyment, you know, with it. And then there's those like me who can't, like it's just a one-way highway. I think we're just learning about what addiction is, both chemically and emotionally. You know, most of the treatments, you know, we don't have good science on it. We haven't done very good studying. I think it's a very interesting new field that there are more questions than answers when it comes to any type of addiction. So I guess, I mean, that's kind of a non-answer, but yeah, I think it's a subject that a lot of people have opinions about, and there's just not much of anything grounded in science into what causes addiction, what fixes addiction, or even what actually is a good definition of addiction.
Good enough of an answer for me.
That's all I got.
Cool. Thanks for the take on addiction. It's obviously near and dear to my heart, both personally and what I'm trying to do to help others. But I just hope we can help each other, because I think it's one of the toughest things when you're deep in, you don't want to talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Hey, tell me about the book, dude. You're writing a book?
Yeah. Like, I got to travel around and do some cool adventures and good storytelling. I mean, I've thought about it for forever, and I'm just trying to finally actually, you know, get that done. It just seems like something I would be remiss if I didn't do. You know, the timing, it's good therapy for me to kind of go through all of that.
I got one more little question. What are the 1 or 2 songs that jumpstart your inner groove no matter what? Like, really fire you up and get you going? I know you're not a music guy on the bike, but kind of what one or two songs just absolutely, you just start moving your feet no matter what?
Well, I don't look at it that way. I usually get a song stuck in my head that have lyrics related to my endeavor, like even stupid songs like Kate Bush Running Up That Hill.
Yeah.
Or you change, you know, a couple of words to make them apply to. So you turn them into kind of a self-hypnotic mantra, like Katie Lang's These 3 Days, you know, yesterday, today, everything's great except for these 3 days, which,
yeah,
like going across Australia, that was what was going through my head the entire time. And I just thought that was ironic and funny. You posted just the other day the Johnny Cash version of Hurt. And I meant to, you know, bring this up earlier, but I just forgot.
Well, you did now, so you redeemed yourself.
That is such a perfect song for the athlete addict. Like, there's never been a better song written for that personality type. It's just, it's amazing, you know, how it just gets to the core. And you can, you know, depending on your experience, everybody interprets, you know, things to kind of fit them. And I think with that song, it's really easy to do that. I think it's one of the most amazing songs ever.
You know, I think it's a great song, and I've been a huge fan of Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails from day one. And so I heard that song for years, mm-hmm. and that was not their best song to me. Like, it was just a song.
Right.
And sometimes you dig into the lyrics, and sometimes you absorb the song at surface level between the tempo and the vibe, and just it just kind of hits you all at once. But when Johnny Cash recorded it, and he was practically on his deathbed, I mean, it was just months before he died, he put something into that song that was not there before, not there at all. And a lot of people know that song and hear that song, and they think Johnny Cash wrote it, and they think it's perfect. It is a perfect Johnny Cash song. Mm-hmm. But Trent wrote that song a long time ago.
Right.
But you listen to the Cash version, and you're like, holy shit, that hits you hard. Mm-hmm. But then prepare to be destroyed when you see the video of the Cash version, because all of a sudden, his life goes from start to finish. You're crying. There's tears running down my face every time I watch that video.
I'm the exact same way.
It's literally breathtaking. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of part of what was behind my question. Is there really something that fires you up? But that Johnny Cash version I heard is so deep, just the audio. But then the video... Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Crazy. So you latch onto vocals, you latch onto the lyrics and the meaning, and kind of tagging yourself with what's going on in the song.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it is, you know, it's a way of passing time. It's, you know, self hypnosis. Oh, and another thing you should, if you haven't, speaking of, you know, other podcasts, Andrew Huberman is a neuroscientist. He was on Joe Rogan, and then he's got his own podcast. But he was looking at, and I've always had the question, like, what happens when you know, you're exhausted? Like, that state of, well, how far is too far? Like, what even physiologically happens when your muscles stop? And he literally answered that question. And it's, you know, your muscles fire because of norepinephrine. And he said they stop firing when there's these glia cells, like they reach a limit, and it's like they cut off the norepinephrine, and then your muscles, you know, won't fire, and you know, come to a stop. But he said if you trigger, you know, some dopamine through whatever means, the norepinephrine starts firing again and the whole system works. So with a brain, you know, neurotransmitter, you can get your, you know, locomotion muscles to function. I just find that fascinating. I've never drawn much of a distinction between what is physical and what is mental. Like, I see the brain as an organ, and they're all, you know, intermixed. And, you know, this is a key element, you know, in that. Like, you can control, you know, dopamine release by thought, hearing that song that really, you know, kind of hits your heartstrings and fires you up. That triggers dopamine. So that is going to make you literally faster.
That's fascinating. Like, when I did this ride 2 weeks ago, you know, I'm usually religious about hydration. So I'll make sure that I drink 3 liters a day for 3 days before going into a big event. And this one, I just decided to do it 2 days before, like a day and a half. So I was not hydrated. I did not have the fitness. I'm carrying much more weight, but I just had this positive mental spin, and I was just going to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think of that, and I understand kind of your mindset and your positivity, or even your vision of getting to your destination. But now that you say that, on what Andrew said, Huberman, right?
Yeah.
That at the end of an event, or towards a crossroads of an event, you know, how can you draw on that dopamine to get you the last leg. That's fascinating.
The other really important, you know, aspect of that, I can remember with the Butte 100, you know, mountain bike race invited me out 2 or 3 years ago just to give their, you know, like night before, you know, kind of pep talk. And the gist of what I tried to say was be realistic with your goals and your expectations. Because one, like, you know, anything off-road, it's really hard to predict. If you set hardcore, I'm going to hit checkpoint one at X amount of time. Well, what if it rains? I mean, there could be 100 different things that happen.
Yeah.
You know, I just caution people to be really careful with that, because as much as attaining your goals is motivating, missing your goals is really demotivating.
Yeah, it's worse.
You want to avoid that. And what this Huberman I saw recently just do is it's dopamine reward prediction error. I think he did the study on it, or he was relating somebody else's study. But if I say, Roger, you know, I'm going to invite you over for dinner tomorrow night, it is going to be the best steak that you have ever had in your entire life. Like, you're going to be smiling for a day. That sets an expectation. Now, when you go to eat that steak, if it's not the best steak that you've ever had, you're going to secrete less dopamine than if you hadn't been prepped at all, or if you had low expectations. There is a measurable difference in the dopamine that's elicited from that. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, that is fascinating. You know, I've come across that in business through customer service, where if you have a customer who comes to your business with an expectation and you start failing on that expectation, you know, it's you're dead. Instead of them either coming in a little more neutral, or they have a high expectation and you meet it. Well, if you meet it up front initially, you can actually screw up towards the end of the customer service interaction and still recover well. Mm-hmm. This kind of came up through a couple of big studies, but it's fascinating. It really is.
There's another neuroscientist I like to listen to, Jordan Peterson, and he's got a self-help book, and admittedly on his end, it's, you know, a little bit, you know, cheesy, like number one, you know, make your bed, all the, you know, simple, you know, rules to live by that everybody knows, but he says they are really important. And one of them is, if your life, like your day-to-day life, isn't working for you, you need to lower your expectations. And that the problem with a lot of people is your expectations are just too high. And if you lower them, and he gets the, you know, that it's different than, you know, traditional goal modeling. Well, you got to set, if you want to hit high goals, you have to set high goals. But in terms of mental health, that isn't always true. And a lot of times you just have to lower the bar and then, you know, start meeting that bar. And then you can start, you know, working on increasing it. But otherwise, you're just going to dig a hole if you're underperforming every day.
Yeah. You know, go to YouTube and look up Admiral McRaven. Texas commencement speech. Admiral McRaven was a Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
So this guy, he coined the phrase, make your bed. And he gives this commencement speech to, I think it's University of Texas. Longhorns, is that who that university is?
Yeah.
But he gives this commencement speech and he goes, okay, here are the top 10 lessons I learned as a Navy SEAL that you're going to learn, that you're going to need in life. It's probably the most powerful speech outside of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech that I've ever heard in my life. Just amazing, blow you out of the water. But I think it's those little victories that we need to start to link together. And then as far as, you know, Dr. Jordan Peterson, you know, I like that too. You know, what I say is, what's the lowest common denominator of your basic to-dos? You know, I'm a checklist guy and a spreadsheet guy, and I'd have a list of 50 things. Well, now I have 3 absolute must-dos today or less. I love
that. I saw you, you know, mention that, and I thought that's kind of along the same lines. Like, don't give yourself, you wake up and give yourself 20 things to do.
You can't.
Do 3.
You can. I can't even do 10. I can't even do 10. Right. And I don't always do 3, but at least I have a much higher chance of success with 3. And then you put a bunch of days and a bunch of weeks and months and years together of successful getting shit done. And that's a shot of dopamine like you can't believe. It's like, I'm a good human. I'm doing stuff. I didn't set myself up for failure by saying I was going to run 100 miles today and I was going to, you know, wash the car and paint the house and take the kids to soccer. You know, you can't do it all. And you got to choose your battles, and it's the lowest common denominator. We could keep going forever, but I think we should stop. Really,
this has been really fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. Really quick, just give me the lowdown on your Washington ride last week that you were going to go out and do. What was that, 680 miles on the Washington Trail? And you had to come home a little bit early, but that was by your own smart choice.
Yeah. So, I mean, 2020, you know, the year of COVID, like I signed up to do the Dirty Kanza XL. So I was going to do that in May or whenever it is. And then that got postponed and then, you know, got canceled. And I was just looking for something to do. And then this Cross Washington Trail was supposed to be an event September 13th. But then like just 2 days before, like everything was looking good. I was all set to go. And then 2 days before, wildfires just went haywire. Yeah. And all the land was shut down and it was a no-go. But then I thought, you know, if I get a window, you know, before, you know, kind of winter comes, which like around here is kind of now, I thought I'd just give it a try and at least go out and ride it. And I did that. And I was very pleasantly surprised with how good I felt, especially initially. The first half I did in under 2 days. And I rode the first 39 hours straight. And it was like, I wasn't forcing myself to like ride without sleep. Like it was, I couldn't have been happier. I could have gone the second night, but then I went conservative. I went out slow and loved it. And then I had a sodium problem, or, you know, at least I'm pretty sure it was a sodium problem. You know, I for sure going to look into it. Like, you know, it's a wonder if you treat your body pretty poorly for 10 years, you know, you would assume you do some damage to it. So on one hand, I was shockingly surprised at how well I did for the first half. Like it was way beyond my expectations for having only ridden for a year. But then I did run into a problem, and I, you know, it could be related, could be unrelated. You know, it might just be, you know, I'm used to my sodium burn rate of a whatever 35 or 5 year old, and maybe it's a lot higher now. And maybe I just, you know, simply have to adjust that. You know, things, you know, we change with age, and maybe that's one of them for me.
Yeah. And you were just pulling water out of the stream and hitting them with iodine, right? You had no filter?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't do filters. I mean, I have one, but I rarely use it. They get clogged up and they take a while. I've never gotten sick off of iodine treated water, and I've treated some nasty water. So part of it is just that I trust it and it's small and compact.
Yeah.
It's easy. Nothing to go wrong.
So you pulled out early. You didn't do the full 680, but how far did you go and what amount of time on the Washington Trail?
I did 550 in a little over 4 days.
Wow. That's crazy, dude. You're a stud. With
a lot of climbing. Yeah, I would definitely not call it a gravel route. I would call it a mountain bike route. It's not hard mountain biking, but it's, you know, you want some tires on your bike. Yeah. You want some good geometry.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. Like Washington is just such a beautiful state. You go from rainforest to high desert.
Yeah. Crazy. So what's the plan with the book? Are we gonna see that sometime soon, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, I think it's gonna take me probably 4 more months to finish it. So I hope to be done winter, early spring, and try and get that rolling.
Have you nailed down a title, or is that in progress?
I've got a couple of working titles.
Okay.
Well, one mainly. Finding the One That Breaks Me is what I want to call it.
That's a good one. Well, we'll look for that, and we'll certainly share whatever update and information you have. And then the last thing I need from you, John, is just parting words. What? Wrap it up for us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's an honor and a privilege to be a part of this. I really like what you're doing with this podcast. It's a great, refreshing, different look at people. And I think a lot of folks can get a lot out of that. It's very human. It's a very human, honest interview. And I think that has a lot of value.
Well, I'm glad it brings value to you. I treasure our friendship. We were able to do some business work together a couple of years ago. And then here we are. So I'm glad you found your center for now. And I hope you keep pushing in the right direction. And I'm sure there's many, many people around the world who would back me up on this, but you're a superstar and you're incredibly motivating to the rest of us. And I just want to say thank you for everything you've done for me to push me. Part of me getting on my bike 2 weeks ago and slogging away for 24 hours was thinking of you.
I appreciate that. That's very generous of you to say.
Well, it's total truth. So, okay. So for anybody else, if you could leave a review, share the podcast, leave a rating. And then if you need any links to any of my other stuff, you can check me out on social media. And as John Stampstead gets closer to finishing his Life Adventures book, I'll be sure to share all of that as well. So, John, great to see you, buddy. You look awesome.
Thanks, Roger. You too. We'll talk soon.
Okay. See ya.
Really a pleasure.
Yep. Bye.